Blog Talk Radio.
Thing.
Yo, look at Grinch with some stupid bell bottom pants, man.
Your Word. Shoes, man, they make you look like a fool.
Word!
Why, you dive churches, I'll knock you through Sunday and be waiting for you on Monday. You're too young to have seen the sights of Esther Mammy and Pappy about Dolomite.
Planet Earth was my place of birth, born to be the sole controller of the universe. Besides a part of the map, I hit first. Any environment I can adapt. When it gets worse, the rough gets going, the going gets rough. When I start blowing the mic, mic bust. The next day to shake from the power I generate. People in Cali used to think it was earthquakes. Hard on the boulevard, so I fold guard and never get scarred. I'm guard, but it seems like I'm locked in hell. Looking over the edge, but the R never fell. A trip to slip, cause my knife's got grip. Stand on my own 2 feet and come equipped. Any stage I'm seen on, a mic I fiend on. I stand alone and need nothing to lean on. Going for self with a long way to go. So much to say, but I still flow slow. I come correct and I won't look back. Cause it ain't where you're from, it's where you're at. Even the
nobody smiling.
Relax in my room and escape from New York and return through the wound of the world as a thought. Thinking how hard it was to be born. Me being queen with no physical form. Playing yourself with one destination to reach the best part of life's creation. 9 months later, a job well done. Make way, cause here I come. Since I made it this far, can't stop now. There's a will and a way, and I got the know-how to be all I can be and more, and see all there is to see before. I'm called to go back to the essence. It's a lot to learn, so I study my lessons. I thought the ghetto was the worst that could happen to me. I'm glad I listened when my father was rapping to me. Cause back in the days, they lived in caves. Exiled from the original man and straight away. Now that's what I call hard times. I'd rather be here to exercise the mind. Then I take the thought around the world twice. From knowledge to form, back to knowledge precise. Across the desert that's hot as the Arabian. But they couldn't cave me in, cause I'm the Asian. Reaching for the city of Mecca, visit Medina. Visions of Nefertiti, then I seen her. Mind keeps traveling, I'll be back after. I stop and think about the brothers and sisters in Africa. Return the doors through the eye of a needle. For miles I fought and I just brought the people. Under the dark skies, on the dark side. Not only there, but right here to the far side. So now is the time for us to react. Take a trip through the mind and when you get back, understand your third eye seen all of that. It ain't where you're from, it's where you're at. Even the
nobody's smiling. Nobody's smiling.
Even
nobody's smiling. Nobody's smiling.
No more props, I want property in every barrel. Nobody's stopping me because of the feral rhymes I make. Give me real estate for me to own. Wherever I bless a microphone, 007 is back and relaxing, on point and reacting, and ready for action. I'm so low-key that you might not see me, incognito and taking it easy. Quiet is kept on a hush-hush in front of a crowd. I get loud as a bone rush, but calm, keep a low pro and play the background. Over the whack, rapper put the mic back down. So rip it, break it in half, go ahead and slam it. Cause when it's time to build, I'm a mechanical bonding, amending, attaching and blending. So many solos, there is no ending. People in my neighborhood, they know I'm good. From London to Hollywood, wherever I stood. Footprints remain on stage ever since. Sidewalks and streets, I leave fossils. And then, when I had sex, I left my name on next. My trademark was left throughout the projects. I used to get rich when I played CeeLo. When I roll 4, 5, 6, they go keto. So I collect my cast and slide. I got my back, my guns on my side. It shouldn't have to be like that. I guess it ain't where you're from, it's where you're at. Even the
nobody's smiling. Nobody's smiling.
I'm from the the motherfucking saga continues.
Die, nigga. We're born and die, nigga. You've been dying for 400 years. Niggas know how to die. Niggas don't know nothing else but dying. Niggas dream about dying. I'm a motherfucking nigga. I got a case for spitting in a motherfucker's face.
so I'm not gonna care all that. All I see is niggas getting harassed and can't do nothing about it but get a foot in they ass. Yo, but if every nigga grabbed a nine and started shooting motherfuckers, it would put them in line. And that's how it's supposed to be when a pussy ass nigga try to fuck with me. Yo, because it's useless to try to kill a nigga, cause nigga, a motherfucking real nigga don't die.
Catch it on TV with chicken hanging from our mouths. You'll know it's revolution because there won't be no commercial. When the revolution comes, when the revolution comes, preacher pimps are gonna split the scene with the communion wine stuck in their back pockets. Faggots won't be so funny then, and all the junkies will quit their nod and wake up when the revolution comes. When the revolution comes, transit cops will be crushed by the trains after losing their guns, and blood will run through the streets of Harlem, drowning anything without substance when the revolution comes. When the revolution comes. When the revolution comes. I hope pearly white teeth fall out of the mouths that speak of revolution without reference. The course of revolution is 360 degrees. Understand the cycle that never ends. Understand the beginning to be the end, and nothing is in between but space and time that I make or you make to relate or not to relate to the world outside my mind, your mind. Speak not of revolution until you are willing to eat rats to survive. When the revolution comes. When the revolution comes, when the revolution comes, guns and rifles will be taking the place of poems and essays. Black cultural centers will be fought supplying the revolutionaries with food and arms when the revolution comes. When the revolution comes, white death will fall off the walls of museums and churches, breaking the lie that enslaved our mothers. When the revolution comes, when the revolution comes, Jesus Christ is going to be standing on the corner of Lenox Avenue and 125th Street, trying to catch the first gypsy cab out of Harlem. When the revolution comes, when the revolution comes, Jew merchants will give away monster balls and gefilte fish to anyone they see with an afro. Frank Stiffen will give away the Apollo to the first person he sees wearing a blue dashiki. When the revolution comes, when the revolution comes, afros gonna be trying to straighten their heads, and straightened heads gonna be trying to wear afros. When the revolution comes, when the revolution comes, when the revolution comes,
when the revolution comes.
But until then, you know and I know niggas will party and bullshit and party and bullshit and party and bullshit and party and bullshit and party. Man, I sure don't need them dick suckers fucking with me right now. Man, my motherfucking mind right now, man.
It's
it's all to maintain. So it's a life mentality. If it be a tragedy, why you come and handle me? Don't slam me down and grab me. Just to put on handcuffs and charge me with resistance. When they told me throw my hands up, it's all to maintain. So it's a life mentality. If it be a tragedy, why you come and handle me? Don't slam me down and grab me. Just to put on handcuffs and charge me with resistance. When they told me throw my hands up, just cause I'm a black man. Put your 2G lack and mouth full of goes and my neck and wrist frozen. They label me a drug lord, supplying my third wall. When I only put some ghetto D with maps in my tank dog. Money in the bank dog. Them haters don't like that. Bitch, this ain't the slave days. Us niggas gon' fight back. You crackin' stuff like that. All up in the magazine. Put me on a TV screen and I'm gon' say the same thing. You can call me racist. Black man in this white world. I'm sick of singing sellout niggas. Married to these white girls. Knowing they the enemy. Can't never be no friend to me. I just get my dick sucked. Nut in their mouth instantly. They ain't nothing but freaks, yo. You feel that's what you need, though. While you off at work with something, she fuck one of your people. Now you want to kill something. Pull off you with OJ. If you ain't got the dream team and you ain't winning your case, I get up all in your face and call you a straight house nigga. I know you gon' press charges on me with my pistol off in your mouth, nigga. It's all to maintain. So the life mentality. If it be a tragedy, some wife will come and hassle me. Gon' slam me down and wrestle me. Just to put on handcuffs and charge me with resistance. When they told me throw my hands up, it's all to maintain. So the life mentality. If it be a tragedy, some wife will come and hassle me. Gon' slam me down and wrestle me. Just to put on handcuffs and charge me with resistance. When they told me throw my hands up. Black man kill a black man. Coolly loving that. Black man kill a white man, they sentencing him to death. White man kill a black man, then scream about self-defense. Break it down to manslaughter with all of the evidence. Ever since I've been here, been nothing but sin here. I done backed about the game just to pursue my career. So I'ma say this loud and clear. Motherfuck the white man. Ku Klux Klan talk shit, but they don't want to start shit. Niggas today ignorant, festing my left generation. Sweet triggers with no hesitation. When I kind of the altercation, rapping is my occupation, but I still ride with my pistol and drop the top a low low so I can feel a wind blow. Pull up on side of white folks, smile, show every goal I got. Smoking on some sticky sticky, but y'all like to call it pop. Young black man calling shots, middle finger to all the cops. Suck a nigga dick pulling your Glock out for a traffic stop. Here's all to maintain, so the life mentality. If it be a tragedy, then white folks come and hassle me. Gon' slam me down and rouse me. Just to put on handcuffs and show me with resistance. When they told me throw my hands up, it's all to maintain. So the life mentality. If it be a tragedy, then white folks come and hassle me. Gon' slam me down and rouse me. Just to put on handcuffs and show me with resistance. When they told me throw my hands up, it's all to maintain. So the life mentality. If it be a tragedy. Niggas out here talking about a nigga hating on them. Fuck you talking about a nigga hating on you. Bitch ass nigga. You know who hating on you? The DA and the judge hating on your bitch ass nigga. The police and all that type of shit, nigga. Fuck you talking about a nigga hating on you behind a hoe. A real nigga bad to piss on.
Black power, black power, black power, black nation. You're tuned in to In Defense of the People, weekly Tuesday night broadcast at 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern time, with your host, People's Political Party, National Chairman Nat Turner, your co-host, National Minister of Defense, Brother Motherland, and myself, the hottest engineer on the ones and twos, National Minister of Communications, Sister Amina. Calling every Tuesday night, same black pace, same black time, at 845-277-9266. That's right, 845-277-9266. You can press the number one to participate. tonight's topic, who said they were leaders? We're going to open up the lines for our host, People's Political Party National Chairman, Nat Turner, and our co-host, National Minister of Defense, Brother Motherland. Black Power, can you hear me, comrade?
Right on. Can y'all hear me? Can y'all
hear me? Black Power, I can hear you loud and clear, Chairman.
Yeah, right on. What up, Black Power, man? Straight up, all power to the people too.
Black Power,
and,
we
just wanna, you know, yeah. You're right. You're over all that. Straight up. You know, just wanna, you know, acknowledge, you know, those who are listening. You know what I'm saying? And our topic tonight was chosen for specific reasons, from a historical context, in order to understand the. Let's say the attitude or the, you know, the sentiments or of the Black collective today, and how we deal with things. You know, there's a root foundation, a source of everything. You know, in the late 80s, Flavor Flav came along. You know, one of the members of Public Enemy, politically charged group, and he started wearing his hat to the side. You know, and a clock. And as a result of Flavor Flav wearing the hat beside the clock, it became a culture, part of the hip-hop culture. Well, you know, everybody's wearing their hats to the side, and it had a particular attitude based on the politically charged rap group Public Enemy. You know, so that's just to give an example of how, you know, people can in our midst and influence us in a way to where we become it. You know, we internalize it. You know, that's why a lot of elders, or even just basically like, you know, persons who consider themselves Black conscious, those who are critical, you know, like of rap music, even some of these politicians, you know, the Negro politicians, you know, were very critical of rap music in the late 80s and 90s, you know, to the point where Tupac came under attack. You know, so the influence on our youth, on our people collectively, children, our youth, young adults, you know, older adults and mature adults and those who are elders and are supposed to pass on wisdom to us, you know, collectively as people. And so when you take a good look, a deep look at the leadership today or this the aura of leadership, you know, what you have, what you get, as far as like coming under various forms of attack, Black people coming under various forms of attack economically, you know, politically, the situation with the police, you know, that the Black Panther Party renamed Pigs due to a relationship that was contradictory from the jump that some could trace back to the slave catcher, you know. And so it's an attitude, you know, in certain parts of the country, down south or what have you, though, it's referred to as swag, you know, and it becomes a way of life. It doesn't necessarily have to be negative, and it ain't always positive either, but it's due to the decadent relationship that Black people collectively have had with the dominant group. So-called white people, Europeans or Caucasians. And during the slavery era, the physical slavery era, the 1850s, you know, going into the 60s, it appeared that physical slavery, and I say physical slavery on purpose, for a purpose, by design, because that's what it was. Physical slavery ended, which simply meant that Black people were no longer held in physical bondage, in chains. And so that was emancipated. It was abolished in the mid-1860s, early 1860s, and became a phenomenon. But the conditions, the relationship between the master and the slave hadn't changed at all. But in the midst of that, the Europeans were preparing themselves, and particularly the white ruling class, whites. You know, if any of you ever may have or have eating a jar of peanuts, you know, planters, you know, that's a living legacy of slavery. And so when post-slavery was on the doorstep, you know, the white ruling class, obviously as a law of nature, had realized that the treatment that they had meted out to African people for several hundred years, that at some point this could turn into a backlash. There's blowback for anything that persons do to perpetrate against another individual or a group of people, even in some cases animals, you know. And so the Europeans were simply thinking ahead, and they saw the writing on the wall with the so-called ending of physical slavery. This projected orthodox story about the Civil War, and it was over, you know, slavery was not. It was simply a disagreement on the part of two groups of capitalists who mode of production had become static with each other, and that's simply what it was about. The industrialized age had been instituted, the so-called founding of the cotton gin by Eli Whitney, and that revolutionized what the capitalists referred to as time is money, money is time, and the speed up of production in the capitalist mode of production. And speed had become into the equation. And so therefore, the machine was faster than the slave's hands. And so this was the contradiction. This was the dilemma. Contrary to the usual story sold towards that Abraham Lincoln had come around some kind of way and then had a Jesus moment and had declared that slavery after several hundred years was all of a sudden inhumane, and that all men were created equal, and so forth and so forth. Abraham Lincoln was assassinated for a particular reason by a particular group of people. It had nothing to do with Abraham Lincoln turning on the South, and that they took revenge by assassinating him. Abraham Lincoln simply meddled in the money affairs, in the moneyed interest groups, the banking cartels, the banking elites that it extended from one end of the Atlantic Ocean to the other side, from London to Eastern America, what they knew as Wall Street, the banking cartels who controlled the shares and the stocks from everything from A to Z, cotton, soybean, and all the rest of the material consumption and production that makes up this country's gross national product. And the commodity, of course, one of those commodities were human beings. These are Africans. For those of you who want to really understand, I suggest you take a look at how Wall Street was founded and why it's called Wall Street in a particular part of Eastern America. And the mass transplantation of human bodies over the ocean in these monthly voyages that began the evolution of black people's dysfunctional problems that we see today, that we have these various specialists from psychiatry to mental issues to psychological issues and whatnot. The latest thing that some of us who are old enough to remember when we came up and we had a chance to watch on television the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde has taken on the new terminology of bipolarism, split personality. And these are the things that began to take effect on African people who were not slaves. No slaves came from Africa. Africans came from Africa and were made slaves when they got here. And due to these voyages over the ocean, began to develop psychological issues that have ballooned into the issues that we see today. For anybody who wants to point out or make it an issue about that was the past, feel welcome to, feel free to. That's what this radio program is for, in defense of the people radio, to what we feel to correctly politicize the people, give the people a clear understanding of the material conditions of black people collectively in this country. And so we start from the root source. We practice root knowledge instead of fruit knowledge. We know that it's mathematically impossible for fruit to grow on any tree without a root. And so this is what we're attempting to do tonight. It just so happened to be that black leadership, is in the spotlight. And so, as I said, black people's, the beginning of the end began going across that ocean and ended up here in the shores of America on the East Coast. Now, this is North America, and we can go back further and talk about what became known as the Caribbean and how African people were brought there first. Somewhere around 1501, contrary to what we're told, some people believe it's 1555. But we know that it was in the 16th century, the early 16th century, that they began to bring the first Africans here. While at the same time, there had also been indigenous black and brown people here with various types of physical formations, morphologies, head textures, and so forth. And so that began the legacy of the displacement of African people. And in the midst of that, being under control of the white ruling class capitalists who use a specific type of labor to accumulate wealth and turn that wealth into capital and take that capital and further endeavors of expansionism. The capitalists have their God who they place their worth on, faith foundation, in terms of its ideological framers of the capitalist system. And one of those was Adam Smith. And Adam Smith had said in his Wealth of Nations, published in the 18th century, 17th century, somewhere along there. And he said that the two greatest discoveries of the capitalists, the Europeans, was India and America. And he meant that in terms of the expansive ideas to expand their ambitions, their personal ambitions, which would eventually lead to mass consumptions of wealth. And so America is the backdrop of that. What you see today is the bastard child of it. As we say, those of us who understand that America is the bastard child of Western Europe, particularly Greater Britain, and that Great Britain is the bastard child of Rome, and Rome is the bastard child of Greece. Just to give you a quick idea of what we're going with, just to give you from a root perspective to understand moving forward and how it works. And so in the midst of slavery, a number of things that transpired for those who also would take an interest in also pointing out that it were not just blacks, that they were also whites and indentured servants and all that, that's not to be debated. It is indeed a fact. But however, we're talking about African people and the experience that African people have experienced in this country for the past 500 years. And as a result of that, in the era of physical slavery, they began to have an extreme value. They had an extreme material value. It is only when the abolishment of physical slavery in the 1860s that black people began to not have any material value. And so as they began to not have any material value, what you would eventually have is a huge mass of African people running around in this country. And as the law of nature goes, even George Washington himself said, for he fear knowing that God is just. And what he meant by that was the things that he did, the things that him and his cronies did would eventually come back around and haunt his descendants, white people collectively. And so they understood that. The generations in the 18th century, the 19th century, and on into what they refer to as Reconstruction. And so in that period leading up to what they called it, you know, the abolishment of slavery, with a thought process where they knew that eventually someone would have to rise up out of this group of displaced people by natural law of nature and become leadership. And that leadership would obviously end up having some type of ideology, some type of thought process, some type of attitude. And so they figured, well, if this was going to potentially take place, and it would, then let's get ahead of it and let us be the ones to shape what that leadership would be like. And today they call that everybody having a price for those who were just starting out. And so that was the going idea. And on their part, because after all, they had done to accumulate mass consumptions of wealth using the force of violence along the way, a number of wars, a number of proxy wars that were funded by the banking families that some of us may be familiar with as the Rothschild banking family, who not only funded one side of the war, of the Civil War, or and even the American Revolution, but they fund both sides of the war because they were strictly business, because war is a racket, so said Smedley Butler, who was one of the military leaders during World War One or Two. And so that's how that works. And so when they began to realize what was taking place, they went to work to establish some type of figureheads that would lead this displaced black population. And so at during this period from the 1840s, 50s, 60s, and on in the Reconstruction, there was, however, a class of what they referred to as Negroes, educated Negroes, before the ending of physical slavery and on into what they call Reconstruction. And so they had been familiar with this class of people. And so it was there from that class of people that they would begin to sift through it, you know, and specifically choose certain individuals that they could take and embrace and mold into the leadership. And this is something that is rarely discussed when we have gatherings about meeting of the minds and what have you. It's not back on incidents that what I'm saying is rarely discussed. It's not something that is good for certain forces that still operate within our midst. And so one of these individuals, or it's a number of individuals that were sought after, and they were rounded up. And when they had shaped this fabricated leadership, they sealed the deal by just basically searching for someone who can be the face of it, who can lead it. You know, which brilliant individual that could lead this fabricated leadership. And so their conclusion was that it was Booker T. Washington. They chose Booker T. Washington. Now, historically, or his ideology, some say that Booker T. Washington you know, espouse black nationalism, and that he beat Marcus Garvey to the point, I mean, to the punch. And during this period, there's this thing about this debate between W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington. And so this is why high schools in certain cities of America is named after Booker T. Washington. And so he was one of those individuals that were projected on to, you know, black children, black youth or whatever in school as a national hero figure. And so Booker T. Washington was chosen, and there were about 13 of them. And this is how this organization came to be. And Booker T. Washington's ideas for the advancement of the so-called Negro race, the Tuskegee Institute, and all these different things did not come at the sole hands of Booker T. Washington. And there were unseen forces who were working behind the scenes and, of course, using capital. Specific family or force, unseen forces behind the scene is the Carnegie family. Some of you may be familiar with that last name, Carnegie. Some people like to call it, you know, pronounce it Carnegie. Some people say Carnegie. There was one Andrew Carnegie who was the patriarch of that family, which is extended all the way down to today. And so the Carnegies were the ones who developed this idea, this plan to shape the leadership going into the future for the simple fact of, you know, protecting their interests. But some of us may know as gatekeeping, you know, gatekeeping the rest of the masses of displaced people who ended up, you know, around the country or began to spread, you know, from the South or whatever, you know, off of the plantation. And in the meantime, during Reconstruction, the Europeans had also morphed themselves into something else, which turns out to be sharecropped, a new way to, you know, keep the so-called freed slaves in perpetual bondage. And so the idea of sharecropping. Sharecropping simply, you know, consisted of those who knew how to plant and, you know, needing, you know, machinery, materials such as seed, tools, you know, plant. And so they would go to the merchants, those who control, you know, the merchant class, and, you know, basically held in bondage, whereas whatever they produced, the percentage went back to those whom they, you know, loaned or borrowed, you know, the machinery from, and seed, having these various patents on, you know, the things that were necessary in order to become farmers. And so this is a sort of a evolution of the black farmers coming out of the slavery and in the Reconstruction and on into, you know, like Jim Crow, the, you know, the 40s, 50s, and the 60s. And so it's very clear how this black leadership was started, how it was founded. It was never founded in the sense of some type of black militancy, in the sense where the attitude was threatening enough to topple the white ruling class and therefore the white collective. However, coming on the heels of certain militants, certain brothers who felt that by any means necessary that they would be able to liberate or free the slaves, and particularly Denmark Vesey, Gabriel Prosser, and Nat Turner in the late 1820s and early 1830s. Gabriel Prosser and Denmark Vesey, they were sold out by the day what we call the snitch, the house Negro or the house nigger. And their attempts were derailed. But however, Nat Turner was able to have some success. And in the midst of that, David Walker had been the articulator of it in writing, which he produced what is now referred to as David Walker's Appeal. David Walker simply said that there would come a time when the slave master would be caught with his pants down, or will have his pants down, and that it will be only incumbent upon the slave and the perfect time and the right time verbatim for the slave to sever his slave master's head from his shoulder and liberate himself. And if the slave didn't take advantage of that opportunity and sever his master's head from the rest of his body, then the slave deserved to be treated like a slave. There was no in-between. There was no some of the way, a part of the way. Like H.R.A.P. Brown said a long time ago, there's no such thing as being a little pregnant. You're pregnant or you're not. You're free or you're a slave. And to some people, this type of language, some may even consider to be rhetoric, but it's a fact. It's a historical fact. And to some, it may be, you know, a bit, you know, difficult to swallow or embrace. And we understand that. People's political party, we understand that. And so therefore, we take you, you know, to the basics to get you to where we feel that our people need to be collectively. There may be those who may have some differences or whatever. There's no basic one monolithic way to liberation. However, there is one liberation, and it doesn't have any other definition. Liberation simply means to be free of the oppressive conditions of another people who have placed themselves over you as their lord and master. And so as a law of nature, it is only a natural response that that group will respond in the way that it is forced to respond due to the conditions under which they find themselves. You know, and so understanding that, this is why the white ruling class families set out to create black leadership to get ahead of potential dangers that could topple their dominance, their rule. I mean, after all, black people in general collectively had been getting treated like they were animals. The level of abuse, physical abuse, mental abuse, and psychological abuse, the level of splitting up families the way that they did, and what you see today as the busing system where our children are being transported from uptown to way across the river or what have you, you know, that is the legacy of the splitting up and displacement and the, you know, this thing about, you know, long distances that separated our families and us becoming strangers. And so much so that the descendants today have found a way to profit from it through these various forms of DNA institutes that charge black people to find out who their great-great-great-great-grandparents split up our great-great-great-grandparents from. So those whites who feel that or try to push this thing on to us by the benefit of slavery, they're a goddamn lie. So it's a combination of things. And along the way, you know, I'll insert some things just to give you an idea because it's a domino effect. Okay, but again, this is how the black leadership was established by these white ruling class families, such as the Carnegie family, the Vanderbilt family, and most of us know these families by the Rockefeller family. Okay, and so the other point of that was to establish institutes, schools that were based on trying to teach black people such things as etiquette, how to, you know, place, you know, dishware and silverware on the table. In other words, they call themselves trying to re-civilize us and teach us mannerisms. And a lot of these colleges and some of these schools that we see today that are historically, this is how they began, as sort of like trade schools. You know, one school in particular that's, you know, if not the most famous, one of the most famous black or historically black colleges is Spelman College. Spelman College was a product of that, product of Rockefeller money. And the Rockefellers had a plan, and John D's wife, Laura, decided to do what is now known today as philanthropy and all these other programs that you see today. And so as a result of her work, she set up this college along with Rockefeller money, and she named that school, or her family, descendants or what have you, or, you know, during her time, the school was decided to be named Spelman. Her last name was Spelman, Laura Spelman. The Spelmans had intermarried with the Rockefeller family, and that is how she got her last name, her maiden name, Spelman, and that is how Spelman College got its name. There's a number of examples, but you have to ask yourself, what was the real and true intentions of, you know, the foundation of Spelman College, you know, and other schools, Bethune-Cookman, the early schools, you know, like the, you know, that opened up, and, you know, where certain classes of so-called Negro people were allowed to receive an education. And from this crew, from this group, you know, this is where they began to, you know, get their, gather their, you know, their brain trust that they can build into black leaders. Do we have any calls, Conrad? Just wanted to ask. Hello? Can y'all hear me? Hello? Hello, hello, hello. Here we go again. Ooh, Lord. Hello? Hello? Hello?
The moment that is bound to shape the future.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it. They telling me to get it. It said that the message I was bringing brought destruction. I put the pants in the bag and said, fuck them. Here's a land that never gave a damn about a brother like me from the jump. They'd rather see me slumped, face down, shot 5 or 6 times with my kid and a mama in the cop car, brown and I'm gone. Stop lying. It's a black and white thing. Redneck ass judge. Would rather watch that nigga hang than indict what's white, not right. Fuck a news feed. Black man got the same needs as the Jews need. Who me? I demand reparations. Fuck a cowboy. I'm a native, robbed of my nation. I'm an African. Black man. Fuck down my language. Got me bringing to a white boy. God, that's insane. And if you ask me why they steadily harass me, I reply with that these motherfuckers nasty. And I'm a god, yet they calling me a nigga. They scared of me, so they try to hide behind the...
You can hear me? All right. Yeah. Okay. I'm back. Yeah. Look. Can y'all hear me?
Black Power. Can
y'all hear me?
Hear you as you were.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Cool.
Black Power.
I don't know at what point you know y'all couldn't hear me, but look, let me just say this for the record, man. You know, it is what it is. You know, it's obviously, you know, that there's some forces, you know, that, you know, messing with, you know, with our phones, or in particularly mine. I couldn't hear anybody. I was asking, had we had any callers, and so I couldn't hear anything. So I was trying to dial back in, hung up and dial back in. But, you know, it is what it is. It's not going to stop anything. You know what I'm saying? We have the right to express ourselves, even under what they claim is our constitutional right. And so we just want the people to know that the very fact that my phone is being tampered with, so I you know, I could not, you know, I stifle, you know, tonight's broadcast, and of course, and particularly the subject matter, So, you know, it is what it is, and we must keep doing what we have to do, keep forging ahead. But we just want our listeners to understand what's taking place here, because sometimes, you know, these things can happen and people can become disillusioned and be led to believe that, you know, the persons who are operating, you know, they don't know what they're doing. This is a waste of time. But we just want our listeners to know that this is a state that is tampering with at least my phone. And you know, I'll continue on in hopes that you all be able to hear me. But, you know, we'll keep doing what we have to do. I've got to keep calling back in or whatever. So, you know, it is what it is. But what I was asking, do we have any callers yet in the queue that wanted to comment, you know, as I was going along? Can you hear me, brother?
Black Power, Chairman, no, we don't have any callers. And once again, listeners, if you want to chime in, make sure you press 1, Black Power, as you were, Chairman.
Yeah, right on. All right. So as I was saying, you know, just talking about, you know, how these unseen forces, you know, had, you know, began to set up some types of institutions, you know, to control the, you know, the thought process, you know, coming off of the legacy of Black rebellion during the era of physical slavery. You know, in particular, as I mentioned, David Walker's appeal, that I would suggest or recommend, you know, to the listeners to read. Just as much as they suggest certain literature for people to read in terms of social engineering them via their thought process or what is referred to as mind shaping, to control the ideological frame of thought and how you react to incidents that take place, and particularly with Black people. We are so subjected and bombarded with what we know as police terrorism, you know, being terrorized by the pig. And, you know, we understand that the pig is an arm of the state. And that may seem like brutal language, you know, to some people. It is not done to intimidate our people. It is done in the same sense as the hardcore realities out here on the street in terms of terminologies and language and labels and stuff that we use today, even amongst ourselves as a people, you know. But, you know, getting back to this fabrication of Black leadership. And so, therefore, you know, entering the, you know, the installation of these institutions in New Orleans, Louisiana, that's referred to as Dillard University. Dillard University set up as sort of subgroups until they congealed into one and became Dillard University. And the forces behind the instituting of Dillard University known as the Rosenwald family. And some of us who are from New Orleans or maybe familiar with such things as the Rosenwald Center, which is right across the way from the concentration camp that they refer to as the prison. And so it's these unseen forces that worked in the South. Just a couple of examples. And so as a result, once again, you know, the establishment of, you know, what that leadership would look like in terms of the particular type of education. Now, moving on into the 20th century, around 1904, there was another group of Negroes or intellectuals, if you want to call them that, that had gotten amongst themselves at the behest of one Henry Minton. And Henry Minton had got together with some other persons of like mind and established what was known as the Boule, and which is, you know, commonly known throughout the Black collegiate world. This is not personal. It's a historical analysis of what we believe in politicized and politically educated people. And the purpose of the Boule, according to its founders, was to attract persons or individuals of like minds who has studied the things they study, even such things as philosophy, business, and, you know, and what have you. In other words, they were in the process of establishing their own little Negro enclave set apart from the rest of the black masses. However, this group became known as the Black Intelligentsia. And it was this intelligentsia group that would naturally be relied upon to do the thinking for the rest of the black masses of America. And this is around 1904. Now, the foundation or the model of the Boule was based on what is known as Skull and Bones. And Skull and Bones is set up at Yale University in the 1820s, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, somewhere in the 18th century, I mean late 19th century, early 20th century. Well, anyway, the Skull and Bones was set up as a result of the William Trust Association. It was a trust fund that was set up, and William Russell, the Russell Trust Association, William Russell. And as a result of them have been able to accumulate capital through the dope trade, and particularly the opium dope trade that had came out of Afghanistan or India, with what you see today is what you know today as heroin. And so a lot of these old families from the old British crown, some of you may be familiar with Vidal Sassoon hair products. The Sassoons was a family that were given a monopoly also in selling dope and some other families. And they, accumulated a lot of capital and a lot of wealth. And so this is what the Boule was modeled upon the Skull and Bones. And the Skull and Bones historically has basically been a mind-shaping thing in itself among the white ruling class, where certain individuals are tapped or chosen for specific, leadership within branches of industry, politics, economics, and what have you. A lot of those old families, the Bush family, a number of those individuals who had also become leaders of intelligence, the military intelligence apparatus of America. So that was what the Boule was based on. Now, the ideology of the Boule consisted of, according to Charles Wesley is the so-called black man who had written the history of the fraternities, in the black collegiate world. And according to Charles Wesley himself, so many words that the Boule was created to keep Negro intellectuals from the clutches of Marcus Garvey. And Honorable Marcus Garvey, Mosiah Marcus Garvey, emerged out of the Caribbean and had traveled certain parts of the world and began to take in the conditions of the diaspora, and also the moneyed interest groups who financed or were able to profit from the slave trade, and moving on to the other captives' ventures, spreading around the rest of the habitable world. And so as a result of Garvey's intentions, Garvey had come under attack by several individuals. And we know for a fact, according to Jackie Robinson, who became the so-called first Negro baseball player to integrate what is now known as Major League Baseball. And inside Jackie Robinson's autobiography, he has a section on what he referred to as Negro leadership. According to Jackie Robinson during this time, Jackie Robinson said that he knew for a fact that if not all the Negro leadership, that most of them were Rockefeller-made men. And that is a fact according to Jackie Robinson. Jackie Robinson himself also belonged to the bootleg. So from that historical legacy of the founding, the bootleg in 1904, combined with Rockefeller money interests, other families, Carnegie families, and another family referred to as the Harriman family, banking cartel families who control wealth through the early stages of raping the natural resources, or raping foreign countries with natural resources, in particular to Africa. But oil, diamonds, Garvey had become aware of that because he was understanding the international scene, and he went beyond civil rights. He went beyond mere tokenism, and he began to understand how the capitalists operated, and that their stakes and their stocks and their shares in companies where they can accumulate massive amounts of wealth. So Garvey began to turn his attention toward Africa. And Garvey had said that if the oil was good for Rockefeller, then it's good for the Africans. If diamonds were good for people like Professor Rosegang or the Oppenheimers, then it was good for Africans. And if the gold also was good for Rothschild, then the gold was good for Africans. So therefore, he developed the concept of Africa for the Africans, which became a slogan, even a battle cry or a war cry for the diaspora around the world. And so as a result of Garvey's intentions, he began to further black nationalism, developing a sense of pride as a result of the centuries of European terrorism, psychological warfare, and such things as our physical features, in particularly our hair texture. And so into Madam C.J. Walker and her invention. And so this was one of the ways where, in an adaptive sense, due to the Eurocentric view of the standard of beauty that had been heaped in particularly, you know, upon black women. And so that's how Madam C.J. Walker began to accumulate massive amounts of wealth. And that is one of the influences, as I said, of psychological warfare. And so Garvey, being as effective as he was, such individuals as A. Philip Randolph, who started the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, who at the time was considered to be a militant, who had spearheaded the first farce on Washington. That's how some of us know it. Others of us know it as the March on Washington. And A. Philip Randolph, also along with a lesser-known individual named Alain Locke. Alain Locke had become the first Negro Rhodes Scholar. And then to this day, there are still so-called African-Americans who are selected and chosen as a Rhodes Scholar recipient, therefore the opportunity to study in Britain, in particularly the schools of London School of Economics, Oxford University, you know, along those lines, a University of London. And we understand that that is not free, that in somehow, some kind of way, that the Europeans decided that they would all of a sudden have a Jesus moment and decide that Africans should be their equals. When you take a good look at the Rhodes Scholar program and its foundation and its inception, one begins to realize that, first of all, the scholarship has to be named after someone, so therefore a thing or a person or a land or a region called Rhodes. And so there was one Cecil Rhodes, who was British. Cecil Rhodes had an idea from the time to understand that he was a late teen in his early 20s. And as this story about Cecil Rhodes had got a pail bucket and a spade and went stood over what was referred to as the Witwatersrand Rhine in South Africa, a pretty much crater that was known to possess gold. And it is said that Cecil Rhodes had figured that he was going to get rich. But of course, Cecil Rhodes could not have started all that on his own. So therefore, Cecil Rhodes was funded, financed, fronted some money to get his start by the Rothschild banking family. This is how Cecil Rhodes was able to do what he did. And so as a result of that, Cecil Rhodes had dumped his money into these trusts and these series of wills that he had left behind. And inside that will was the purpose of the regain and the reestablishment of the British Empire over America after having lost in the so-called American Revolution. And that was the purpose of that. And in an expanded form, Cecil Rhodes also would include non-whites, because the British Empire was an empire that tentacles stretched as far as Australia, Canada, India, China. If you look today, you will see some of these countries are still aligned to this very day in terms of this G8, G7, G9, and what have you. And so when Mr. Bat, the expansion era of the Rhodes Trust, wills to set up the scholarships, which began to include the so-called Negro. The Negro was included simply for the fact of further control purposes. And therefore, it is said that one accepts the Rhodes Scholarship, one enters the Rhodes Scholarship realm and begins to study, then one's objective and goal, according to Cecil Rhodes, each one of those would be an agent on the part of the British Empire to win back America and therefore control other groups within America. And this is how the Negro became to be the first Rhodes Scholar, which was Alain Locke. Alain Locke couldn't stand Marcus Garvey's guts. At one point, he uses the term gorilla to refer to Marcus Garvey. The other individual who appears to have been the leader of this group was W.B.E.B. Du Bois. This may be troubling, you know, for certain of our listeners. And we understand and know that this is not personal. Once again, it's a political analysis, what we feel is correct politicized analysis of the leadership, since therefore we're the ones who are going to be the followers historically. And so this antagonism had brewed between W.E.B. Du Bois and Marcus Garvey. Marcus Garvey at some point began to suspect something was up with Du Bois, and therefore he in the publication of the literature today on him referred to as the philosophies and the philosophy and opinions of Marcus Garvey. For anybody who's interested in understanding more, I suggest you read that book to where he gets to explain more about Du Bois. Du Bois, we're told 3 years later, after the Boule was founded, that Du Bois was in New York, and that Du Bois is the founder of the NAACP. And that is the orthodox version that we have all been told when we were children. But there's more to it than meets the eye. He could not have possibly been the sole founder, but yet the sole face of it. And when one takes a deeper look at the NAACP, one begins to understand that there were other sinister forces that worked behind the scenes to establish the NAACP. And even to the point where the NAACP's original name wasn't as we know it today. It was something like the National Negro Committee. And there were certain forces inside of this group that felt this name may have been a bit much. And so it was suggested name change. And one figure, one individual inside of this group is Mary Wright Ovington, O-V-I-N-G-T-O-N. And she was one of the key figures in the foundation or the establishment of the NAACP. The NAACP set up a board of directors, And on this board of directors was the one and only Joe Elias Spingon. And this was the man who created what they give out yearly or every other year. It's referred to as the Spingon Award. He created this award, named it after himself, and he began to distribute these medals to accomplished African-Americans or successful blacks. And so when you look at the historical background of the Spingon Awards moving forward, I believe the first recipient was Ernest Just. And so from him on to this day, there's no coincidence that when you look down the line and see these individuals and begin to understand that there's a connecting part to it in terms of the historic leadership, which is what takes us to what Jackie Robinson has said, that he had said that he knew for a fact that if it wasn't all the black leaders, most of them were Rockefeller-made men. And so the connection's there. One of these individuals who had received the Spingon Award was Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson has a checkered past that cannot, no way, shape, or form be coincidental. We'll get back to him, but we just wanted to lay, you know, the early foundation of how this black leadership was fabricated in service of these unseen forces whose objective and goal was to keep their elevated status intact, that the structure or the class structure even wasn't altered, or there was no toppling from the top down or dismantling of their control of things after they had exploited the physical slave trade, which is a fact that established what is now known as the capitalist system. There are those who even look like us, they will try to come into our midst and even help these Europeans along and try to fabricate the story that physical slave trade was pre-capitalist or it was primitive capitalism and it was apart from what is now known as the capitalist system today. As a matter of fact, this book refers to as the 1619 Project. There's a chapter in there where it speaks about, you know, the capitalist system and its connection, its evolution from the slave trade. And even, you know, this group that, you know, was collected to partake in the compilation of that book, you can take a look at them in terms of what referred to as the Black Petty Bourgeoisie. Okay, and so Joe Spingon was one. The other was Arthur Spingon. Joe Spingon was also military intelligence. And during World War One, the capitalists were concerned in the midst of having been lured into World War One, I believe, with the it has something to do with the sinking of the Lusitania ship. And so the Germans had took out these ads that were published in the top newspapers, and particularly New York. And they had took out these ads, you know, declaring that, you know, any ships or what have you sailed in these occupied women, they will be blasted to pieces. And so this is how America was made to enter into World War One. And during that period, the state's intelligence apparatus, there was some concern that if they had joined this war, then they were contemplating whether or not that they were spread too thin. Could they hold the fort down in America? And could they participate in the war, which would require a lot of manpower, a lot of bodies, you see? And so therefore, you know, the institution of people volunteering and all these kind of things, you know, to join the Great War, to liberate Europe from the first form of what was referred to as the the Axis powers or the evil powers. And so in the midst of that concern, the Europeans knew they had been treating black people like shit. And so therefore, at some point in time, like David Walker had said, there will come a time when a European gets caught with his pants down. And that was one of those times. So the Europeans were already thinking ahead. So what they did was they pretty much rounded up those who they figured that had already established, as I said, from Booker T. Washington forward, what is referred to as Negro leadership. And so there was this meeting that had took place, a private meeting off the radar, off whatever you want to call it, that where these certain individuals were gathered up and rounded up, and I believe they had convened in Washington, D.C. And the purpose of that meeting was to establish a sort of Negro watch group, watchdog group, like you have some of these groups today, you know, what they call cop watch. And so this watchdog group was put together and, you know, pretty much told that, well, it's a deal that could be made, that we understand that we have been treating the Negro in a bad way, our Negro brethren, and that we realize that, and that we want to know that, you know, in so many ways that they could keep an eye on possible Negro unrest. And this is their expression of what they refer to as possible Negro unrest. And so the lead of that group was W.E.B. Du Bois. And at, after that meeting, there was also these communications that had been passed back and forth between this group and the leading military intelligence brass, military intelligence officers. If you search hard enough, you may be able to find some of these letters. I managed to read, you know, some of these letters, you know, in certain books. If I can, if it can come to mind, I can, you know, tell you the name of the book if it comes to mind. But, you know, so in the midst of that, this is what was taking place. And so they pretty much cut a deal, and the Europeans said, well, if you can do this, then we promise that when the war is over, then we'll, and we'll, you know, pretty much provide concessions for the for your group, for the for your Negro brethren and sisters. You see, and this is the type of this is the type of treachery that they were willing to perform in exchange for their class, their group within the black masses of the people to be able to live, you know, materially comfortable. You know what I'm saying? You know, and you know where they can. Their wives or their families can, you know, live the type of life that, you know, the white ruling class were able to live. You see, and
Black
this
power.
Is the historical. Yeah, go ahead, brother. Go ahead. What we got?
Black power. Listeners, if you want to chime in on the conversation, just remind you to press one. Power as you watch, Chairman.
Yeah, right on, right on. So they were willing to cut these deals, you know, during the World War One period, and this was we can say sort of the second lynching upon the heels of Reconstruction. There was one before that. We'll get back to it, but of course, when the war was over, you know, black people, you know, were over there, and they came back and they were, you know, treated like shit again. A lot of these lynchings, things that were taking place. Where even, you know, the so-called Negro soldiers had come back and they were, you know, they were proud to don that, you know, their military, whatever their particular type of uniform, whatever. And a lot of them, as a result of that, were attacked out in the open, you know, as a result of that. And so Du Bois them had to scramble, sort of create some radicalism, A. Philip Randolph, and also another individual known as Bayard Rustin. You know, it's like saying by in the word yard together, Bayard Rustin. Bayard Rustin is the political theoretician who had been a man of several hats. One instance, Bayard Rustin had embraced the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, at the same time being an integrationist, and also having a nerve enough to even espouse Pan-Africanism. But he was a man of many hats because Bayard Rustin had understood the concept of the Hegelian tactic. Okay? And Bayard Rustin is the same individual who began to instruct this brilliant young man who had come along and who was a great orator, who was very charismatic, who can get people's ear, and he was very eloquent when he spoke. And he had came up with a dream speech called I Have a Dream Speech. And this person became known as famous Martin Luther King Jr. Bayard Rustin was his instructor, and Bayard Rustin had began to instruct Martin Luther King in the ideology or philosophy of one Mahatma Gandhi, who was the leader of the Indian people in what's known as the subcontinent of India in Central Asia. And during the same period, during the British Imperial Empire days, their tentacles, as I said, had stretched from Australia to Canada and also Africa, Southern Africa. And at this time, the British had been transporting, you know, people within their empire, and particularly black and brown people within their empire from India to South Africa, bringing them in to perform, you know, manual tasks. And the British at this time had begun to refer to the Indian people as the word known as coolies, C-O-O-L-I-E-S. They were referred to as coolies. So they were brought in into that South African population. And of course, it's the same tactic that they use in the day when they do Renaissance 2020 in Chicago or 2012 in Chicago, where they, you know, close down particular districts and schools and transport, you know, the young people over into, you know, another district, knowing damn well that these are opposed in street fashions, these opposing street tribes.
Like Pop.
Enough for a Yeah, go ahead, brother. Go ahead. What we got?
We got a caller.
Yeah, go ahead. With every call, yeah, they call.
346, go ahead, Carl.
Question of kind of caller. Yeah, tell us your name. What you got?
Now, what's going on? This is Brother Cassidy. Black Power, Brother Matt. Black Power, Brother Aaron.
What's up, comrade?
Yo.
Hey, what's happening?
Your whole role. What's going on?
Your whole role, man. Yes, sir.
If you don't mind, Brother Matt, if you could finish up your point, and then I just wanted to give a little spiritual word. I don't need much time, so if you don't mind, I'm on for the rest of the show. So go ahead, Matt, and finish up your point.
Well, yeah, cool.
And you go, right on.
Look. So basically what I'm saying is, during that period, during that era, you know, the British had been transporting around, you know, the people in their empire, you know, manual labor. So they had a huge influx of so-called Indians in South Africa. And if some of you all can remember, I think Spike Lee had made a movie referred to as Mississippi Masala. You see, and it's similar, you know, where here's an Indian woman. You see what I'm saying? So a lot of that had came off the backs of that. Now, during this period, the war had begun to take place, and the same thing was felt about, you know, the black population in South Africa, where the British would be spread too thin across their empire, you know, having to, you know, take on, you know, these evil axes. And so at some point, the Africans began to realize that the Indians and the Africans had something in common. They were both getting their butts kicked by the same forces. So here's this thing, this evolution, this idea about the enemy, my enemy is my friend. And so, you know, this idea had looked good on the part of the Africans, and the Africans, of course, naturally going to Gandhi as the leader. And Gandhi pretty much said every man for himself. And so he turned it down because they wanted to unify and go in coalition and overthrow the British, get the British out of both of them here. And Gandhi had refused to join in coalition with them. Not only did he do that, but Gandhi also had some derogatory terms of expression or description of even the African. Basically, what the white people had been saying, that the African is uncivilized, is uncouth, and all this stuff, this, that, and the other, and blah, blah, blah. And so Gandhi refused. And this is in Gandhi's own autobiography, his terminology, the way he felt about the African. And so Bayard Rustin either had to do one of two things. He either had to understand, if he clearly knew about Gandhiism, then he had to have understood Gandhi's ideology and his sentiments and feelings toward Bayard Rustin's brethren and sister in Africa. And so Bayard Rustin began to instruct Martin Luther King in Gandhiism. Okay, and so this is how Martin Luther King had begun to develop his ideology and move forward. You see what I'm saying? And so in the midst of that, King, you know, began to, you know, what we are led to believe developed this reputation, you see. And so these unseen forces began to observe King. And before King at the church that everybody is familiar, I think it's Ebenezer Baptist Church or whatever, there was one elder who was there who was a minister. His name was Vernon Johns. And this is the man that preceded King at that church. And Vernon Johns was a militant, and so he had to be replaced. And so therefore the Boulay replaced him and inserted Martin Luther King into the picture. You see, and that's how Martin Luther King got his start. You see, but look, I'm going to stop right there, Conrad. We're going to give you a minute, man. You know what I'm saying? Look, we ain't going to rush this. You know what I'm saying? We're not going to rush it. We got a half an hour to go. But, you know, so we're going to stop right here and, go on, do what you need to do, you know, express yourself, you know, what you want to hit us with, Conrad. Girl, you got the full Black Power.
Black Power, Black Power, Black Power, everybody, all the listeners. I want to give a Black Power to Brother Nat, National Chairman, Brother Nat Turner. Woo, Black Power, Black Power. My voice is a little bit gone, but you know, yes sir, yes sir. It's good to be back in this. It's good to be black in the cypher. It's good to be back in the cypher. Oh,
yes
man.
Indeed.
But check it out.
Black Power.
Minister Cobb, what's going on, Mr. Amina, and all of the members of the PPP, I want to give a Black Power out to the People's Political Party. You know, you guys, you know, since y'all's inception, you know what I'm saying, has really been burning it up on the airwaves, social media, since the radio show has started giving political education. So we give a Black Power salute to that. And all the listeners listening, what's up, Black Power, what's going on? You know what I'm saying? So tonight, I just want to, just coming from the heart, just something spiritual, you know, so we don't forget, in case we forget, you know what I'm saying? That, you know, we're the original people of the Almighty Wise God Creator. You know what I'm saying? I just want to take time, first off, to just state that. We take time to just let that sit, just sizzle with you for a minute. You know what I'm saying? Just look at your beautiful black skin and your beautiful black face and your beautiful black body and your beautiful black aura and all the beautiful black things around you that we create, or that we make at least, right? Just acknowledge the fact, the absolute 100% fact that you are the original people of the earth, right? Let's be grateful for that, right? Because we don't want to be second to last. We don't want to be last, but first, right? Always will be and always have been. You know, I want to take this time out to give thanks to the Almighty Wise Creator God, you know, that which is the omniscient, you know what I'm saying? It can't be touched, you know, the universal, almighty, the ultimate force, you know what I'm saying? The negative and the positive, the up and the down, the polarities, you know, all of the different hermetic hidden texts involved and all of that, it all coincides to that very first belief. You know, it goes back to that very first original story, right? In the holy city of Abydos, right? In the holy temple of Sekhiwan, you know, in that great original story of the immaculate inception, you know what I'm saying? And the Virgin Mary that they call it now, the Black Madonna of Set. You know what I'm saying? And the great stories that are really science, that which is considered mythology, but it's really science. But it's written on the walls, which once is called hieroglyphics, but we know the true name to be the Medinetta. You know what I'm saying? And on that Medinetta, we see all throughout the great walls and halls and tombs of Kemet, which is called Egypt by the cracker, you know, that we see this great story of the first story, of the many, many, many stories that have been rewritten, recycled, and passed back down to us, regurgitated out of the mouth of the enemy and passed back to us, right, as abuse and control and enforcement and policy and police and things of that nature, right? It all boils down to us being the spiritual people. We have always been the spiritual people. And, in fact, it leads me to a now talking about HBCUs, you know, because we've always been a spiritual people, it has been the blatant attempt of the enemy. And unfortunately, these attempts in many ways have been successful. It has been the blatant attempt of the enemy to make us unspiritual, to remove us from our center, from our spiritual reality, right? We learn that spirituality is reality, right? I believe the first time I heard that was Father James Smalls, right? Great, great brother, right? But how spirituality is reality, right? So what's real to us is spiritual to us, right? And that's the vibe that I'm on right now, you know what I'm saying? In the Holy Quran, we talk about how we're always being tested, right? We're always being tested. You'll be tested with food. You'll be tested with water. You'll be tested with loss of life. You'll be tested with money. You'll be tested with rain. It also says in the Holy Quran, it talks about how Allah is the creator and the giver of color. And then it says, in the book, it says that, and who would choose such a color, right? So, you know, just certain things, certain spiritual things, right? So I want to kind of just keep that same spiritual feel, you know what I'm saying? And I don't want us ever to forget that we have a duty to do spiritually. When it comes to spiritual consciousness, I've always said this, you know, in the movement, I think one of the places or points or categories that I see that we lack, you know, is spirituality. You know what I'm saying? Kind of veering away from that spirituality, you know, there should be more research done. There should be more reading done. You know, the things that are said to us, we should take notes and we should go back and research and let that settle into our spirits, right? And we have that realization. Once we have the realization, we can start to create a reality, right? Realization, reality. And once we have that reality, we can start to live in our spiritual aspects, right? Because spirituality is reality, right? So the reality that we're facing current day here in America, the reality that we're facing is we're seeing many different things start to come up during a time that's so of the utmost importance, right, that's ever been really in the last few decades. And we're living at the fall of the American empire, right? This is the fall of the American empire. So with that fall, we're seeing that a lot of things are coming down with it. So I kind of want to just touch on a few of those things before I pass it back to Chairman Nathaniel, you know. Now, this war, or these rumors of wars, at least, that we see all over the news, right? Everybody knows that something's going on in Ukraine, something's going on between Ukraine and Russia. Everybody knows that something's going on in America, something's going on with America and Russia. Everybody knows that something's going on the Eastern Hemisphere, something's going on with North Korea, something's going on with Korea. There's something going on. The Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad says in the book, The Fall of America, he said that there's a lot of talk on the radio, a lot of talk in the newspaper of war and rumors of war. I want to touch on this concept of proxy war. What is a proxy war, family? A proxy war is a war that's carried out between two parties or more. It can be conventional war or it can be non-conventional war. It doesn't make a difference. And conventional war is when you have a military that is funded. A conventional military is a military that is funded by whatever force of economy drives that nation, right? So if it's socialism, that's what the military is funded by. If it's communism, if it's capitalism, that's what the military is funded by. A good example of a conventional military would be the United States of America's military. Then you have an unconventional war, unconventional military. Another word for that would be guerrilla warfare or a guerrilla force, a militia. These are those who are funded primarily by the people, right? These are those who are funded both financially, spiritually, and mentally by the people. These are where you see your warriors and not so much your soldiers. The warriors are not paid by contract to fight. They fight the war because their war is the war must be fought, and the soldier is under contract, and they're getting money for participating in a role of war, in a theater of war that play their role, right? So what we're seeing now on the Jews or the news, we're seeing proxy war. We're seeing America and Russia and China even go to war with one another through smaller countries like Ukraine, like Belarus, like Georgia. And when I'm talking about the state of Georgia, I'm talking about the Georgia south of Russia in the Caucasus region of that area. But they're taking these America, Canada, Russia, China. They're using these smaller nations to go to war with one another in proxy, in stance of the larger nation. So if that's hard to understand, imagine playing a video game, right? You're the one that's controlling. You have the controller, but what you're seeing on a screen is a proxy image, right? That image is created through digital numbers and all kind of different special fancy things they do with technology, CGI, and things of that nature. But you're in control. And because you're in control, you can choose to do what you want by never having to show your face, never having to answer. Hell, you can even pause the game, reset the game. You can take the game out and start a whole game all over again. Unfortunately, geopolitics doesn't work like that. You can't restart a nation. You can't restart a people. You see, it's funny, literally, hilariously, comically funny that some of our people are in an uproar almost even of what is happening in Ukraine and Russia, but we're not cognizant of what's been happening to us for the last hundred years, for the last few hundred years, which has been nothing short of ethnic cleansing and genocide. Unless we forget that the same nation, Russia, China, America, Canada, the UK, and all of the nations in between, Holland, Sweden, the Netherlands, all of them are guilty of genocide and ethnic cleansing, and all of them, including Ukraine, owe reparations to black people. We shouldn't be feeling sympathy, or we should have no sympathy in us at least, but we get it, right? That's why I started spiritually, because we are people that feel for other people, being the original people. But we got to examine that shit. We got to examine this sensitive feeling that we have when we see the loss of life of white people, when we see the loss of life of white children, when we see the loss of life and we say, oh, that may be a little bit too extreme, but just hold your horse and hear me out for a second here. What we have on our hands is another so-called Jewish Holocaust experience, where we're seeing white people go to war with white people, and they're trying to entertain out of you a feeling of remorse, so that if they decide to instill some type of ongoing process to enlist those into a war that we didn't ask for, a war that we have no profit from or gain no profit for, we see they're trying to bring that sympathy out of you, similar to 9-1-1, right? So we look at this and we have to understand that these nations who are involved in these proxy battles are nations who are guilty and should be brought to international court, should be brought to the people's court and be charged with ethnic cleansing and genocide. How Ukraine has only been around for 25 years, I could be a little less or more on the number, but they haven't been around for more than 30 years, if I'm not mistaken, right? Now, how then can I say of this nation, Ukraine, that's only been around for under 30 years, owes black folks reparations? We have to understand that the people from Ukraine come from Russia. They migrated from Russia. They are rebelled out of Russia. And Russia has its hand in the genocide, and has its hand in the genocide of ethnic cleansing of black people then and today, i.e. in Jamaica, in the high mountain regions of Jamaica, Russia, Canada, along with America, are farm mining mercury and destroying the land in Jamaica right now as we speak. You see what I'm saying? Aluminum, I'm sorry, not mercury, but aluminum. Farming aluminum in the land, messing up the land, leaving giant toxic puddles in Jamaica. And this is Russia's stamp. Russia has a stamp on it. So if you see how it's funny how they then turn it on you, right? We think back to Brother Malcolm when he said, be careful, because the media will make your greatest enemy your friend and your friend your greatest enemy. I just wanted to chime in tonight to let us know and for us to be able to, you know, just have some type of insight as to what's going on with these proxy wars. Let's not forget that there's a proxy war going on with the germ warfare. That is a proxy war. It is a war between which nation. Go ahead, Nat.
No, I want to say this to you. Look, man, we're going to do a show on that, man. You read my mind. I want to do a show, you know, like what you're talking about. You know what I'm saying? It's like a lead up to it. It's like a lead up to it. So, you know, we establish, like, you know, like the way people thinking and how people can be led into these things and, you know, made to believe this shit is, like, legit. You know what I'm saying? That's why, like, you know, I say, like, give black people idea of, like, World War I. Who the forces behind it? Did you know that this was taking place? Why these people was claiming going over there to get rid of evil? Why these people? You know what I'm saying? But we're going to do a show on that, bro. You know what I'm saying? We're going to do a show on that. Look, I got another call, if I want to make sure I get as many people in if I can. You know what I'm saying? But, you know, hold that thought, bro, and you dropped a lot. You dropped a whole lot. accumulated, man, and we're going to do a show, and we have to do a part two, but I want to do a show on that. I want to do a show on it, and you're hitting it right on the head, bro, and this is what this is about, bro, you know, politically educating our people, you know what I'm saying, because we've been misguided for the past, you know, 400 or 500 years, and it's like, you know, we have to snatch back the narrative, you know, we have to snatch back the narrative, and so, but again, you know, we're going to do a show on that, bro, we're going to do a show on that, you know, and, you know, but, man, it's always good hearing from you, bro, you know what I'm saying, keep doing what you're doing. Keep doing what you're doing, bro, because it is very necessary. You know, this shit is war, bro. And if we don't get our people minds, take our minds back from the state, then we're going to be doomed as a people. And it won't be but a handful of us, man, that'll make it out of this shit. You see what I'm saying? But, yeah, Conrad, man, nothing but love here, bro. You know what I'm saying? I just want to get, you know, try to get this other call in. And we go from there. So, Conrad, keep doing what you're doing, bro. You're straight up. You know what I'm saying? Black Cloud.
Yes, sir, Black Power. And to everybody listening, I say Black Power to you. Don't forget that there is things that we can use to protect ourselves, especially with our immunity. I don't want us to forget right about Dr. Aleem Muhammad and the Your Immunity Project. Whenever we get a chance, definitely look up Dr. Aleem, Your Immunity Project on Facebook, and check out all of the great immune-building things that he has on his website. You can visit his website at www.doctor, spelled out the whole word, Dr. Aleem, A-L-I-M.com, and order the food substance that he has called Paxamune. It's great to help you defend yourself against any viruses that may come about. And with that said, I want to pass it back to the PPP, Black Power.
That's what happened. That's what happened, brother. Black Power, man. We love you, brother. You heard me straight up. You know what I'm saying? Right on. You know? Look, we got another call online, Conrad.
Black Power. Go ahead, 516.
516. What's your name and your question and comment if you don't mind?
Peace. I don't mind. How are you brothers doing? My name is El Asia Essence Earth, and I would like to build upon what the brother prior to myself stated, and he and I heard you brothers also say that this is war, and I understand from the perspective of the black man and the fatherhood status and what it is to be a man that war is something that you all are keen to, because that's your prowess. That is what you are designed to do. You are designed to protect us. You are designed to establish an area of solitude and peace for your family so that there is no turmoil, that your family has nothing to fear. You are the protectors. I understand that. But coming from the perspective of an original mother, in the beginning was blackness. But that blackness wasn't the man. The blackness was the womb. Within the womb was complete darkness. And from that darkness sprang forth all of the children of the planet Earth. And when you speak of war in Ukraine, and you speak of war in Rwanda, or you speak of genocide in certain areas, you speak from a perspective of a father. And a father can only know his child once the mother has revealed his status as the father of the child she has conceived. But a mother loves all of her children equally. And as the original woman, the original Eve, who is the mother of all of these children on the planet Earth, black, white, Spanish, however you identify, you came from the black woman first. And then you diverged into whatever you identify as today. The original woman cries out because her children's blood is being shed, and it's being shed indiscriminately by fathers who know not that these are also their own children. You're the original man. You know as well as I do that these are our children, wayward though they may be. Now, how would you deal with a wayward child of your own household? Would you disown them? Would you disregard them? Or would you give them the proper chastisement and correction? See, we can't turn our backs on them because that's what they felt when we exiled them to the Caucasus in the first place. They felt that their parents had abandoned them. They felt orphaned, and the environment that we cast them to due to their devilishment that they were causing amongst the original people, when we banished them, that set a certain thing in their DNA the same way as the post-traumatic slave syndrome says something in our DNA. So we have to accept that we are partly responsible for their nature. We are their parents. Now it's our responsibility to correct them the same way we would correct any other child that has gone astray from the righteous path that any other parent would want for their children to follow. It is far past the time for the original woman to step forward and say, these are my children, and I must take control of their behavior. Their fathers have done their best, but now I must step forward and say, no, child, this is the way. And if you cannot obey the righteous path that I, your mother, am setting forth for you, then we will allow your father to annihilate you, because the time has come for that to occur. There is no more sympathy. There is no more please. There is no more help me. There is no more of that. When we talk about all of these things of war and whatnot, that's no different than being in a house with multiple siblings from different fathers. A mother knows how to handle that. You're all mine. Regardless of who your daddy is, you all came from me. And I will not tolerate in my house this chaos. It is time for the original woman to step forward and say, this chaos will no longer occur in my house. For I am represented by the earth. I am called earth by the 5%, the true 5%, not those who claim to be, but the true 5%, regardless of the banner they wear, they know who they are. They know that this is time for the mother to step forward and say, give me my children that I may correct them with love and with strictness and discipline. They need it from mama. Daddy is harsh, and that is his role. That's what you're supposed to be. You go to battle. You fight for us. But we must be gentle, because while you are at battle, we have to plant seeds. We have to nurture gardens. We have to make sure sprouts don't drown and get oversun and this and that. That takes a tender hand, much like crochet and calligraphy. It takes a certain finesse that the mother must give to the child. For too long, we have allowed the white man's nature of living in caves and having a harsh existence to be the nature that we adopted. But original people came from an abundant land. Africa gave us plenty. We had no worries when we were where we came from. We only had worries when we came outside of the best part. The best part was always reserved for us. They had the worst part. And think about that when you think about their nature. They were reared in an environment that could give them no other choice. So think about the things that they are doing, given the environment their DNA originates from, and also our responsibility as their original mother and father to correct our wayward child. I think they called it, what was it, prodigal son. The son that ran off and went away to wherever and did whatever, but his father always prayed that he would come back and recognize that he was part of this family and he had a righteous purpose. That's all we really want. That's all we really want. That's why they fear us mixing with them, because they know that as soon as they mix with us, they will annihilate themselves. They will cease to be. The devilish man can't exist alongside God. We built on that earlier this afternoon when you spoke on my melanin and how my melanin was present. Melanin dominates. Melanin is the dominant gene no matter what. We are original. Anything else is but a carbon copy. And we can't be upset at them for trying to be like us. We just have to guide them in the right direction. And a mother's touch is what is needed right now. Right now, we need the mothers to stand up and say, no more of my babies will die in a senseless war. No more will I birth for you fodder for your factories. No more will I birth for you workers for your fields. No more will I birth for you bodies in your hospitals and your experiments. It's time for the mothers to say, our wombs are sacred, and we will no longer sacrifice our sacred wombs than the existence of life coming forth for your foolishness. It's time for the mothers to step up. It's time. I hear you, brothers. I love you, brothers. I love all you, brothers. You have carried the line when no one else would. You have done your duty, and your mothers are proud. Your grandmothers, your great-grandmothers are proud. But know this, where your mother is, she was alive in her mother's womb when her mother was in her mother's womb. So as your grandmother carried your mother was already alive within her great-grandmother, because only within the original woman do the ovaries already produce all of the eggs that will ever produce a human being in life. The testicles produce sperm in the moment. Your mother goes back 3-4 generations and you don't even realize it. It's time for the mothers to take back their children. It's time for the mothers.
Let me say this, we ain't got but a few more minutes left, but look, we're gonna continue, the subject, the topic, and because I don't plan on skimming over nothing. We'll just try to lay down like some groundwork. But, let me say this here, we understand the relationship, with Europeans and black and brown people on the earth in the political context, what you saying is scientific. You see what I'm saying? In terms of, the whole genetics and the capabilities to have unlimited production in terms of the different, groups and types of people on the planet. It's been, at least several thousand years since, this separation point. But through the years and over history, even their own scientists and scholars and intellectuals, something like that, understand their own relationship, and which is, what I was having a conversation with one of these city council persons. And so I was laying it out and saying so many words that their whole psyche, I've heard people use the word like neurosis, psychopathology, these different types of things, or dysfunctionalism, to try to sum up the European psyche, his mindset, the things that drive him. But look, I did want to just try to set the tone for us, for a future show to where we can go a bit into that. But I just wanted just a clear understanding on, the whole purpose is to understand, from a political perspective and how Europeans seek to, to dominate the earth, the natural resources, and because it's the end game now. But what the whole purpose of this show is to take black people back to a point in the stage that was completely, kept from them in exchange for the usual and the orthodox explanation of how black leaders derive and how black leaders were created and who said they were black leaders, who made them black leaders. You see what I'm saying? I try to tell people,
approved by your enemy, they're automatically suspect. Like, why would your enemy approve your liberator? Why would your oppressor approve your liberator? That's why I've always questioned, going back in time, right? I went to the Gina 6 March. I don't know if y'all remember the Gina 6 March. It was not long after Katrina. But I went to the Gina 6 March, myself and a few friends. Even though I had evacuated from New Orleans for Katrina, I was in Dallas. We drove from Dallas to Gina, Louisiana, because I was like, oh, hell no. So when I went to the Gina 6 March, it was exactly what you're saying. I understand. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so I'm like, and Al Sharpton is here, and the news media is surrounding them like they're approved, like they're okay. They're the okay leaders of the black community. But the for real leaders, the ones that made waves, they got almost no media attention. They got no newspaper reporters. They barely had press passes. And it was hard for them to maneuver and get their group that they had organized busloads of people for the Gina 6 March, those people that were deemed a thorn in the side of the establishment, had a hard time getting their busloads of people even to a prominent spot during the march or during the advocation for the removal of literal nooses from a tree in the 2000s. You know what I'm saying? Like, if Jesse Jackson is cool and
Look, I got to cut you off because we got like 2 minutes left. And we're going, you know, we'll continue next week. You know what I'm saying? But I got, you know, so we can, you know, we got 2 minutes left. And, you know, man, like I said, you know, we have any more calls, so we ain't get to them. But, you know, we going to continue this same topic next week. You know what I'm saying? Ain't no rush. You know what I'm saying? You know, same time, 7 p.m., 8 p.m. Eastern. You know what I'm saying? In defense of the people, radio, you know, brought to you by the People's Political Party. And, yes, we are a revolutionary organization, and we believe in the revolutionary transformation of society, so the people, and particularly the black and brown people, black people in specific, you know, can achieve liberation, you know what I'm saying, like Malcolm said, by any means necessary, you know. And so we say black power, and we also say all power to the people, you know. And some of the others say brown power to brown people, red power to red people, yellow power to yellow people, and we understand that. But, you know, again, you know, tune in next week. In Defense of the People Radio, 7 p.m., 8 p.m. Eastern Time. You know what I'm saying? So you say black pop. On that note, Conrad, we got like a minute if you want to throw a little, few little, you know, few little kicks in that grid on.
Say real rock from the rock, an unusual musical happening in a most unusual place. The state prison
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it. It said they were suckers. They wanted me for their army or whatever. Picture me giving a damn. I said never. Here's a land that never gave a damn about a brother like me and myself, because they never did. I wasn't with it, but just that very minute it occurred to me the suckers had authority. Cold sweating as I dwell in my cell. How long has it been? They got me sitting in a state pen. I gotta get out, but that thought was thought before. I contemplated a plan on the cell floor. I'm not a fugitive on the run, but a brother like me begun to be another one. Public enemy serving time, they drew the line, y'all. They criticized me for some crime. Nevertheless, they could not understand that I'm a black man and I can never be a veteran. On the strength of situations unreal, I got a raw deal, so I'm looking for the steal.
Hey, yo, Chuck, you serious? You in the justice, man?
Word them up. I'm looking for that steal.
Yo, man, we gonna break you out of there, man. We ain't gonna like that, man.
Don't you know they got me rotten in the time that I'm serving? Telling you what happened the same time they're sowing. Four of us packed in a cell like slaves. Oh, well, the same motherfucker got us living in his hell. You have to realize what is a form of slavery organized. Another form of devil, straight up, word them up on the level. The reasons are several, most of them federal.
Yeah.
Here's my plan anyway, and I say I got gusto. But only some I can trust, yo. Some do a bit from 1 to 10, but I never did, and plus I never been. I'm on a tier with no tears should ever fall. Cell blocked and locked, I never clock it, y'all. Cause time and time again, time that got me serving to those. To them, I'm not a citizen, but ever when I catch the CO, sleeping on the job, my plan is on go ahead. I want to speak, but I'ma tell you the deal. I got nothing to lose, cause I'm going for the steal.
Yo, Chuck, we gonna break you out of here, man. Where's the strength, G?
I'm going for that